Hello, everybody. Welcome back to This Weird House. I am Nick Bodick, and today we have, as our guest, an incredible author, a gentleman I am actually up against in the Books of Horror Indie Brawl this year, an amazing book that makes me certain I'm not going to win. Mr. Todd Kiesling, how you doing, Todd?
Hi, Nick. It's great to be here, man. And don't sell yourself short. I have an snow cone's chance in hell of getting anywhere in that brawl. So,
I mean, so like, no lie, I'm not just saying this because, you know, you're the guest or whatever, but when that was all going on, like all the voting, or I guess not voting, but like the leave a comment for which books you want to see or whatever.
Yeah.
Devil's Creek was the first one I clicked, and I was like, that book rules. And then I'm still shocked that I'm a part of the thing. Like, it's crazy awesome. how much traction it really has, though. Like, it's much bigger than I anticipated it being.
Yeah, a fan contacted me about submitting it for the brawl, and I had no idea what the hell the brawl was.
Right.
At the time, so I just popped in the, you know, went to the link that he gave me, and I just said, you know, Devil's Creek, and fast forward, you know, to this spring, and I have people coming up to me who are, you know, part of the Books of Horror group, and they're buying copies of the book, and, oh, you know, can we get you to sign this and this and all this crap, and it was like, yeah, it didn't really hit home for me how large the Books of Horror group, you know, was at the time, until yeah. They asked me to sign like 32 basketballs at AuthorCon, which was weird.
That's awesome. Yeah, I went to this like this little book fair thing where there were a couple of authors who are in this year's brawl. And I didn't have like a table there or anything. I was just going as a fan of books. And yeah. I was talking to one guy, Jay Bauer, who's in the brawl this year. And I was like, oh yeah, you know, nice to meet you. I'm Nick Bodick. I wrote Daughter's Drawings and the shameless self-promotion. Someone like the organizer of the event who had greeted me coming in, I assumed just as like, oh, welcome. Have a fun look around. She was like, oh my God, you wrote Daughter's Drawings? That's one of my top ones. Nice. On the thing. I was like, oh my goodness, thank you so much. I am awesome. Going to let this go right to my head. But yeah, man, it's been really cool. Like, I'm excited to see it, because as far as I know, it was substantially smaller last year. So to see it go from what I've heard it was last year to what it is now, I imagine it's going to get even bigger, which is great. I need to write another book.
Don't we all?
Yeah, right? Like, I feel like I just blew my wad on Daughter's Drawings. I just, like, it's been all short stories since.
Sometimes it takes, you know, you got to give yourself a little space sometimes to get back into that frame of mind. Like, I know I do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't write anything long form. Well, that's not true. After Devil's Creek, I wrote Scanlines, but it was like, there was like a year, you know, before I wrote anything long form again. And
yeah,
you know, I'm trying to finish a book right now, so I totally understand.
Yeah, I shouldn't say just started, but I've started for the eighth or ninth time what I hope to be my second novel. But then I actually had a bizarre burst of motivation, which I never have, to write. It's my favorite thing to do, and yet I can never bring myself to do it. It's strange, but I think I may have started another novel, which I can say of any number of Google Docs that I have are the beginnings to novels. But you mentioned Scanlines, and that is, I think that's the first thing I ever read by you. I'm fairly certain.
Oddly enough, that's a lot of people's introductions to my work.
Yeah.
I think it's just because how widespread it was. You know, it was in the Nightworms box, and then it gets mentioned on TikTok fairly regularly. And I hesitate. I hesitate to call it a viral thing, but word of mouth has definitely, you know, helped that book make its rounds. Like, I was at StokerCon a couple of weekends ago and met Brian Evanson, and he told me that he loves Scanlines, and I was just like, you know, not worthy.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
that. Oops, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, like, that one connected with me on like a deeper level than most, because reading it, I felt like I remembered my own time as like an edgy 13-year-old, and I was like, damn, dude, like, I was these guys, like, searching, not even necessarily searching. I just came across it, and I watched it, and I was like, oh. Ben, Mike, you guys got to check this out. It's so cool.
Yeah.
I was just, yeah.
I forget who I was talking to, but I was telling them, you know, some behind the scenes stuff about the book and the images that are in it, of you know, the two boys. That's actually the real Danny and Jordan. I got their permission to let me use an old photo that was from Jordan's high school graduation, as a matter of fact.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So they're still alive. So
good to know. So
they wanted me to kill them in the book, though, and that's why that happened. So spoilers.
I've gotten a lot of that. I've gotten, because not to bring it to myself again, but Daughter's Drawings started as like a no sleep story. No sleep is like a Reddit thing. You're familiar. Everything's written in first person, so that was my most popular story there, which I then turned into a novel. So it's the main character is Nick Bodick. The main character's wife is Kimmy, who is my current fiance. Like, and I talked to my family and friends throughout the couple years that I wrote the book, they were all like, oh yes, if I'm in there, you have to kill me. I'm just like, all right, that works for me. Like, it seems to be a common theme for horror writers, I think.
Yeah, it's a badge of honor
for sure. And I would definitely love it if I was killed by, you know, one of my an author that I look up to. Not that anyone looks up to me.
My friend Mercedes Yardley wrote me into a story and killed me. I was dead before the beginning of the story. Like, I'm just dead throughout the whole thing, which is pretty funny.
That's awesome. So to pivot, I jump around on this show a lot, so yeah. Your most recent collection, Cold Black and Infinite, is I know hyperbole, no exaggeration, I'm pretty sure it's my favorite collection of horror fiction I've ever read.
Holy it's shit. Like, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it was curated specifically for me. I can't like overstate how like much, how attuned to my tastes that book, or rather, I guess, how attuned my tastes are to that book. And you wear the Ligotti influence on your sleeve in that one. And I am forever fascinated with Thomas Ligotti and his work and the guy, which I know nothing about. I know nothing about him himself, but what is it about Ligotti that you connected with to the point that you not fashion your stories after him, but that you kind of adopt that, the necessarily worldview, you know what I mean? Like, what is it about him that has influenced you as much as it has?
Well, there's and I'm sure that a lot of the Ligotti purists will crucify me for getting things wrong here. Like, I'm a fan of Ligotti, but I'm not like a diehard, have read every single story he's ever written, and analyzed it, and written an essay about it, you know, fan. But no, I definitely appreciate his work. Very influential on me in a lot of ways. But I think for me, it's a little bit of the sarcastic cynicism that you can find in his stories. And also just the way... Let me back up. The thing that fascinated me most about about Ligotti initially was how he was able to take a very simple concept and imbue it with this quality of a nightmare. like when Pseudopod, they produced the Bungalow House. That was my first exposure to Ligotti.
Okay.
Was Pseudopod. I listened to a lot of podcasts when I was in corporate, because that was the only time I had to read, essentially. And Pseudopod exposed me to a lot of fantastic authors, Ligotti being one of them. And I listened to that story maybe 10 or 15 times, you know, over the course of several weeks, because I couldn't, I was trying to dissect why it was so effective and how he was able to do what he does in that story. And it's a little bit of the narrator, it's the prose, it's the language, but there's also this magic that is uniquely, you know, Ligotti. And I don't think anybody, yes. The only person I know of who can come even close to capturing that is John Padgett, who of course is mm-hmm. Ligotti's protege. So I try to, with my stories, I try to tap into that nightmarish quality, you know, or I strive to do so. I don't always, you know, hit the mark. But I definitely try to tap into that, you know, that surreal quality of it. And also throw my voice in there, because I too am a, you know, bit of a cynic and very sarcastic and dry, you know, in case you couldn't tell.
I hear the exuberance in your voice. Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually kind of discovered Ligotti in a similar way, insofar as I saw, or I read a story of his from The Spectral Link, and it's a story called The Small People. I'm not sure if you're familiar
with
it. Yeah,
I actually have the vinyl recording of that.
That's awesome.
Kadabra Records. As a matter of fact, now that we're talking about Ligotti, I actually have this on my desk. I did not plan this. this script for Crampton.
Oh. Crampton, I have, it's right behind here for me.
The full length script, not the X-Files episode script.
Yes.
I was privileged to actually be hired on to do the interior work on this, and also for Michigan Basement, which I haven't even opened yet.
I'm about 60 pages in. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I have a problem with, I have an addiction to Chiroptera Press, Thomas Ligotti releases.
Right. It's, like, I've got their, just some of their, like, little single story chapbooks that they were doing that had, like, the vinyl covers and stuff. Just,
yeah.
Fantastic quality. Jonathan does a great job there. I love what they're doing.
I've bought a lot of books from a lot of, are they an indie press? I think
they're totally indie. Yeah. They're based out of Philly.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, like Chiroptera and Kadabra. Like Chiroptera is kind of the publishing arm of Kadabra. Like it's the same company.
Okay.
The same people anyway. And just Jonathan's a huge fan of weird fiction, and he gives it the respect it deserves.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, I've bought a lot of books from a lot of indie presses, and nothing comes close with respect to the great many indie presses I've bought from. But like, Chiropteras are just unbelievable.
Yeah,
and they sent an email out recently with their here's what we have coming out next. No dates or anything, but it's like, oh, my second favorite Thomas Ligotti collection. Oh, a Matt Bartlett collection. Mm-hmm. Oh, another Ligotti thing. I'm just like, God damn it. I only have so much money.
Yeah, seriously. They sent like, me, I did the, on, for those who, you know, are listening who don't know me, I'm also a graphic designer. So I specialize in a lot of like interior layout work on books and stuff for publishers, and they hired me a couple of years ago to do the interior for the English translation of Backstage, which is Fabio Frizzi's memoirs. Fabio, an Italian composer who did the work on, who did the film scores for Lucio Fulci.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that was pretty cool to, you know, get that in my hands. And it's a fantastic looking book. Like, they, you know, spared no expense on, you know, the binding, the paper, and everything. It just looks great. So, yeah. Shout out to Jonathan Dennison at Kadabra and Chiroptera. You were awesome, sir.
Yeah, and for whatever my endorsement is worth, everything they have has been incredible that I have. And I, like, it's, they're on fire, and they are going to get all of my money that is required to get all of the books they put out that they said.
Have to practice great restraint.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah.
And I know myself. I tell myself, I'm like, oh, I'll get it, you know, the next round it comes out. That's not going to happen. It's going to go up for pre-order, and I'm going to wonder how I'm going to eat the next day. But, you know. But so yeah, the or anyway, sorry, I was gonna say, so The Small People is the first book that I the first story by Ligotti I read, and I kind of did the same thing. I read it and reread it and reread it, because, and I actually had John Padgett and Matt Carden on for the a couple episodes ago, and we were talking about this, so I don't want to go all the way into it, but there's just such like a, from The Small People and from Ligotti at large, I get such like a unique, almost a physical reaction to what I'm reading. And like, not to be like melodramatic or anything, I don't start like freaking out, but like, there's just kind of that feeling in the pit of my stomach when I read certain Ligotti stories. And that happened with The Small People. I had no idea why. And I was trying to figure out, I was like, why is this story, like, I'm not even particularly like creeped out by it, because it's not an especially scary story, but I'm just like, why, what is it that this guy, Thomas Ligotti, is doing that is like making me read it over and over to try to like dissect it and figure it out?
It's a bit of a riddle, isn't it? Like, it's, whenever I encounter a Ligotti story, it's like, I want to, you know, lift up the hood and see how the engine works. You know, it's like, how are you doing this? Because if I could tap into this, you know, I would be such a better writer. And I think it's this perfect recipe of language and concept and tone, I think, that he has his, you know, he's got his thumb on it, and he knows how to do it, and, you know, every time. So, you know, it definitely comes from, you know, his unique perspective on the world and humanity at large, something that I can appreciate.
Yeah, for sure. And in Cold Black and Infinite, the, I would say the most directly influenced by Ligotti's story is The Smile Factory. And I'm just kind of curious, how did that story come about? Was there, and I guess, beyond the Ligottian influence, there's a lot of very stark imagery in the story, and I guess it's in this kind of uniquely dystopian world that you've built in The Smile Factory. Were there any other influences that played into like how that all looked?
Ligotti, as you mentioned, and Harlan Ellison. I have my mouth and I must scream.
Yes, I can definitely see that influence there.
A lot of the imagery, I think, came from that. The Smile Factory is a bit of a fun story for me, because I was several years into a career in finance for a prominent premier chocolate company that I won't name, but it's a very small list of, you know, companies, so I'm sure you can figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was working in corporate for years. I think it was like 7 or 8 years at that point. And I had originally wanted to do a collection of corporate themed horror stories, and I was going to call it The Smile Factory.
Oh, okay.
And the story that became The Smile Factory was originally going to be called We Have Always Worked for the Company. And it was a lot of what's going on at the redacted company in the story is a, you know, very, very, what's the word I'm looking for? I just blanked on it. It basically, it's a reflection of what was happening in the company that I worked for at the time. There was a lot of turnover. There was one, you know, my manager and I were at odds, and I actually just talked to Neil McRobert about this on the Talking Scared podcast. You know, my boss called me into his office one day, and basically the conversation revolved around my personality and, you know, wanting me to smile more because I made people uncomfortable. And
wow.
I remember saying, you know, like, you want me to wear a mask? Because this is my face. And I didn't know it at the time, but, you know, I'm on the spectrum. And, you know, I wish I had known so that I could throw that up in his face and get HR involved and get him in trouble, because that was bullshit. And it was a bullshit conversation.
Yeah.
But it kind of stemmed from that. There was some bad blood there. We had a upper level executive who was, I think, was actively trying to sabotage our department, because they were trying to cut costs and shit. Anyway, that's a whole lot of corporate nonsense. But the point is, I was very unhappy and miserable, and because of the things that were going, you know, this stupid ass chess match that was going on between executives, the people underneath who were actually doing the work were being negatively impacted. And you could kind of see all the different ways that this company was rotting from the inside. So I took the whole smile conversation, and I started thinking, well, you know, what if our parent company that just bought us and is now trying to dismantle us from the inside out, what if they were like some cosmic entity? And, you know, it kind of went from there. And like, what if the whole point of the company is to manufacture misery that they feed upon? Because that's what it felt like. You know, it's like they're just feeding off our misery. And like, okay, what if getting promoted meant changing your personality and making you less human? There was a whole lot of different things there. And then, you know, corporate culture is another way of saying corporate cult. And yeah, a lot of different concepts kind of came together in one story that I wrote for Catharsis. By the end of it, I realized I didn't need to write a collection at all, because I'd said everything I needed to say about it in that one story. So that's a very long, convoluted way of explaining how The Smile Factory came to be.
That's fascinating. I love when I learn of how real life things make it and how it all gets boiled down into a story. Because, I mean, every writer of every genre has, you know, imbues their stories with you write what you know and all that.
Yeah.
And so wow, there's some pretty direct lines there from real stuff. It's easy to see how that
and there that is happened. a bit of an Easter egg as well. The whole thing about Charles Boyd is this random recurring character that's popped up in a couple of my stories in the past, the oldest being when I was a senior in college. Because I was a senior and really over the college experience by that point. Whenever, you know, in my classes, I made a habit of going to the instructor and saying, look, you know, instead of me writing this 20-page essay on a topic that I have to pick and, you know, support and everything with examples, what if I just write a piece of fiction in the style and tone of the author in question? And a few of my instructors were fascinated by that and took me up on it. And for this one, Charles Boyd came about, he was a character in a story that I wrote that was intended to imitate Borges. And about this computer programmer who happens to like interact with a cosmic being through code. And over time, the company that he works for has become this pharmaceutical type, you know, company. Like, there's another story in Cold Black and Infinite that is a Boyd story. And that is Happy Pills.
Yes.
So that kind of ties in with the Smile Factory a little bit. And it's just a little, you know, wink and nod to prior work. But, like, I don't intend on writing a novel about Boyd or anything like that. It's just that he's this figure. He's kind of like a Randall Flagg type figure. He just pops up from time to time. And,
yeah.
You know.
That is like one of my literary dreams, is to have like an interconnected everything. Like, this book happens over here while this book happens over here, but they are technically connected.
Yeah.
And I love that one thread that does that. And I don't want to have like a, cause I feel like it could be easy to do that, but I want it to be somewhat meaningful. And that sounds like Charles Boyd sounds like a cool way of having gone about that.
Yeah, I've got a few of those. Like, pretty much everything that I'm working on now currently all ties in with the Southland mythos, of which Devil's Creek is kind of the center point of that. But I also have, you know, in short stories, you know, I've got Boyd and I've got a couple of others that, you know, tie into each other, like The Otherland Express from my first collection and 245 to New Zebico exist in the same universe, but they're separate from, you know, the Southland.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, it's fun to do that and reference other material, because it, you know, the more astute reader is going to wonder what that's from. And then they go and check out the other work and, you know,
it's for fun sure. to do that. Yeah, it's good self-promotion in your own stuff.
Kind of. Yeah.
So the, what was I going to say? So like when I say that Cold Black and Infinite is my favorite collection of all time, you actually yourself are just one of probably my top three authors all time because of your body of work. Like it as I said, of Cold Black and Infinite, your body of work just fires on all cylinders for the interests I have within horror, or even just personally. Like, Scanlines hit that 13-year-old edgy teenager me. And then you have the Ligotti influence. There's Lovecraftian influences all over your work. Devil's Creek, like, my favorite topic in horror is cults. I am fascinated by cults. And I have started the novel I am tentatively currently working on is about cults. And then but even more than that, you have The Final Reconciliation, which I am a massive fan of The King in Yellow and everything that surrounds that. And that's actually one I wanted to ask you about next is, I guess, how did that one come about? Or if it's as simple as, oh, I read The King in Yellow, thought it was cool, and decided to write more into it. That's cool. But
so The Final Reconciliation came from True Detective.
Oh, okay.
But like True Detective was kind of like reminded me that The King in Yellow existed. Like, I first read The Yellow Sign in a Chaosium anthology from the late 90s called The Haster Cycle.
Yes. Yep. And I have that one. Love it.
I still have that somewhere. So yeah, that was my first exposure to Chambers. And, you know, being a teenager, I didn't really get it per se. I just thought it was fucking weird and creepy. But, you know, I went on a, you know, my reading interests kind of changed as I went into college and started studying literature and everything. And then True Detective comes out. They drop the King in Yellow reference, and I'm like, why does that sound so familiar? So I go online, and I'm like, oh, shit, I read part of this. And so as the first season of True Detective kind of, you know, took hold, and, you know, of course, Ligotti and, you know, Pizzolatto or Nick Pizzolatto or whatever his name is, you know, ripping off Laird and Ligotti, you know, that controversy aside, you know, it was a good season of TV.
Oh, yeah.
I was fascinated with the idea of there being this banned text or banned media that could drive the viewer or reader insane. And with all the imagery that pops up in the, you know, the poem by what's his name? Oh my God, I can't remember his name. Ambrose Bierce,
yes.
And then, you know, Chambers extrapolating on that. All the imagery seemed like, why hasn't somebody done a metal album about this? Like a, you know, a concept album? Because the imagery is so ripe for a metal album cover. And, you know, I was really into prog metal at the time, Opeth, Mastodon. And I'd always wanted to be in a band, but, you know, I couldn't play anything. And, you know, sort of like, you know, doing covers of Typo Negative songs with Peter Steele's deep vocals, I can't really sing. So it was one of those like perfect marriages of ideas and things I wanted to do. And it all came together in The Final Reconciliation, which, you know, I took the King in Yellow concept of a play that drives people mad, and like, well, what if this was a record that drove people mad? And what happened to the band that would record said record? And what happens if they play it live? And, you know, from there I got to, you know, bring in all sorts of esoteric things and sacred geometry and Lovecraft, Chambers, Haster, which I know Chambers purists don't like the Haster reference, but whatever, it's my story, go write your own. And, you know, I got to have a lot of fun with that. And the result is The Final Reconciliation.
That's so you actually kind of answered another question I had about it, is that, so in addition to The Final Reconciliation, there's a story by John Langan, one by Joseph S. Pulver Sr.
Mm-hmm.
And like three or four others where music is prominently featured as a part of the story. And I was going to ask, like, what was it for you that made it so music was so integral to, or I guess so intertwined with the King, the Haster mythology and King Yellow and all that. So that's very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, the aside from the imagery being perfect for a, you know, a metal album, I think it's just the, in terms of propagation, you know, more people are going to listen to something than they're going to go read a play, much less go see a play,
yeah.
Or read a book or something like that. Music is, you know, it's harder to ignore or at least avoid music.
Yeah, definitely true. So again, jumping around.
Sure.
You mentioned Lovecraft as, you know, influential in as an influence on Final Reconciliation in some way. What is your, I guess, your own personal history with Lovecraft? When did you discover Lovecraft, and do you happen to remember what story it was that you did?
I do.
And I guess kind of how did you what about, like, with Ligotti, when I asked, how did Lovecraft's work resonate with you?
So, I actually talked about this on my very first panel ever at Nikon about 6 or 7 years ago. My first introduction to Lovecraft came through a video game. So I was an only child, and I spent, you know, a lot of time by myself on my computer. And, you know, I was a huge fan of id Software and their games Doom, and, you know, Doom was a huge thing at the time in the early 90s. Then they came out with Quake. And Quake was a three, you know, their first like true 3D game, and all of Quake's like imagery, the music from Nine Inch Nails, and all of that was heavily influenced by Lovecraft. You know, it's this very dark gothic kind of game, and there was a player made level that was modeled after Innsmouth, and the level was called awesome. The Shadow Over Innsmouth. And I'm like, that's really cool. And I was reading in like the notes for the guy who made the level and was talking about H.P. Lovecraft. And I had heard that name before, but I never really like took it upon myself to look him up. And I was in a bookstore in London, Kentucky around 1998. I remember the day I bought it. I found one of those old school collections that had like amazing art.
Mm-hmm.
Like this just really dark, visceral art and shit. Like people being cocooned to buildings, and there's like spiders, and it was just awesome.
Yeah.
I bought that collection because I recognized the name, and I took it home and I read the first story, which was The Rats in the Walls. And it gave me nightmares. I'd never had a piece of fiction give me nightmares. And I grew up reading Stephen King. You know, I was a fan of Stephen King at that point. And had been reading horror for, you know, as long as I could read, really. And Lovecraft was the one that gave me nightmares. And yeah, I just devoured that book. You know, it had The Color Out of Space. It had Call of Cthulhu, Shadow Over Innsmouth. You know, Innsmouth went on to become, you know, that's my favorite Lovecraft story.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it had Pickman's Model, and, you know, it eventually got the cover. I loaned it out. The cover got destroyed by the girl I loaned it to. Her little sister just fucked it all up. But, that was my journey into Lovecraft. And as I, you know, read more horror, you know, as the years went on, I realized just how far reaching Lovecraft's influence, you know, was and still is. And you know, that's kind of, hold on a second, my cat is like laying on my keyboard. That's kind of, you know, was one of the seeds that led to Devil's Creek, because I wanted to write my own mythos that wasn't separate from Lovecraft, but like adjacent to it. Like they exist in the same universe, but Lovecraft's always writing about New England. Well, what if I set it in the South in a landlocked region? How would that work? What would that look like?
Okay.
And from there, over the years, it just kept growing and growing.
That's awesome. The Rats in the Walls is, I won't say it's my favorite Lovecraft story. It's the one I consider to be the scariest. It is the most, like, I don't want to say the least cosmic of cosmic horror from Lovecraft, mm-hmm. but it's the most like direct, like there's a creepy thing happening.
I think it's probably one of the most accessible.
Yes. That better way of putting
like,
it.
Like, doesn't it start with them blowing up the building?
Yeah.
Like the house. Yeah. Like it, you know, definitely starts off with a bang, no pun intended, or intended maybe. Yeah, it was smart of them to put that story first.
Mm-hmm.
In the anthology or the collection that I read.
Yeah, that's, and actually that kind of leads into another question I was going to ask you. So for your own work, you have a ton of short stories, several longer works. If someone were to want to get into your stuff, you know what? I'm going to pause. I don't want to ask that one yet.
Okay.
We'll do that. We'll do that at the end.
Hold that thought.
Yeah. So you mentioned reading Stephen King as, you know, when you were younger. I guess broadly, what got you into writing horror? Like what were like your earliest experiences with the genre?
Well, this may surprise you, but I was a weird child.
You don't say, Todd.
So for as long, you know, as long as I can remember, horror has always been in my life, like as media. Like some of my earliest memories are of, you know, sitting on my mom's lap watching horror movies. She always had a stack of horror novels on the nightstand. You know, she was a big fan of King, maybe a bigger fan of Kuntz, actually, early Kuntz when he was still good. And sorry, Dean. And also Rick Hottala. I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, but she was a big fan of him, Hit, as well. It was just in my environment. And my... Let me back up. I've written about this previously in fiction and nonfiction. So my parents got divorced when I was still an infant. And we actually lived with my great-grandmother for several years. We lived in the upstairs bedroom of her home. So mom was working during the day and going to night school. And my grandmother worked at the only video rental store in town. And this is southeastern Kentucky in the 1980s. So we had one of those rent-to-own top-loading VCRs from Curtis Mathis. And, you know, during the day, to give my granny a break from babysitting me, mom would always rent, like, you know, Disney movies or, you know, kids movies. And then she would also rent some horror movies for herself. And because I'm alone for the most part during the day or up in, you know, our bedroom, I'm just watching these movies and I just go through them all. I don't just stick with the Disney or kids movies. I also watch some of the horror films, and two favorites emerged from, you know, from when I was a child. And one was Maximum Overdrive, which, as we all know, was Stephen King's only directed film. And it's awful in the best way possible. I'll die.
Absolutely.
And, also The Evil Dead 2, Dead by Dawn. And those were like two of, you know, my favorite films, because they were to a 5-year-old, they're just funny and they're fun, you know. They're mm-hmm. they're kind of wacky, and it's not, you know, they're bloody, of course, Evil Dead 2 even, you know, especially, but it's comedic.
Oh yeah,
in a way. And you know, Maximum Overdrive didn't take itself seriously, even though they probably thought it did at the time. Evil Dead 2 definitely didn't. So to a kid, you know, it wasn't scary per se. And, you know, Ash Williams was a hero of mine. And, you know, here's a guy who overcomes significant odds. You know, he has to cut his own hand off, and then he works with that. You know, he puts a chainsaw on it and kills demons. So a story I love to tell is that we had this, you know, back in the day, kids, if you wanted to copy a film, you could get two VCRs, and there was a way of connecting them together. So when you played it on one, you could put the other one to record, and it would record onto a blank cassette. And so we rented Maximum Overdrive, we rented Evil Dead 2, and Mom rented Dirty Dancing. So we had
a wonderful lineup.
We had this one like 6-hour tape, and at the beginning was Maximum Overdrive, Dirty Dancing in the middle, and then Evil Dead 2 at the end. Well, Mom never really got to watch Dirty Dancing because I fast-forwarded through Dirty Dancing so much that it was unwatchable. It ruined that part of the tape. And you know, as far as I know, my mom still has that cassette somewhere. At least I hope so, because I'd love to have that back someday, just for posterity. So yeah, I mean, horror, back to your question, horror has just always been there in my life. It you know, I was doomed from the start. You know, I was the weird kid who was drawing, you know, creepy things, and I was obsessed with Dracula for a time. I was obsessed with Universal Monsters and, you know, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Yes. In a dark, dark room. And, you know, the work of John Blair's, you know, House with a Clock in its Walls, The Lamp and the Warlock's Tomb, I think it is. I could get that title wrong. R.L. Stine's Goosebumps, you know, I was like in fourth grade when that series started, so I was perfect age for it.
Yeah.
Then Fear Street, then Stephen King, then Dean Koontz, and, you know, the rest is history.
Yeah, natural progression.
Yeah.
So, you know, all the artwork for Goosebumps was all done by the same artist, and I'm blanking on his name right now, and I feel terrible about that, but I was at a convention last year, and I look over, and this guy is like Banner or whatever says, oh, artist of all the Goosebumps covers. There was no line.
Oh my God.
So I went over and I got a bunch of things signed by him, got a picture with him. I was like, dude, like you're, and he had a print of my favorite Goosebumps cover, which was, it was kind of an off the wall one. It's like Attack of the Mutant, I think. Uh-huh. And it was like an action figure.
Yeah. That, like, yeah. I remember that one.
And the thing is like running across, and I'm just like, dude, this is incredible. This was my childhood.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And man, like once again, your interests and your influences are Evil Dead 2 is my, like, so Evil Dead is without question my favorite horror franchise ever, period. I love it. And Evil Dead 2 is my favorite of the franchise. And like,
it's my favorite too.
It's as horror comedy goes, I think it's a perfect film. Like, they balance everything out so well. I love that you can see the string that the eye is on when it's flying across the room. Like, everything, flaws and all, make it just so amazing.
And Bruce Campbell can do that flip.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, at least he used to when he was younger.
Yeah.
Yeah, the scene where he's, like, fighting against his possessed hand and
uh-huh.
He grabs the back of his collar and does that yes. front flip. Like, yeah, he could actually do that. That yeah. wasn't a stunt man.
Right. And like, yeah, like the physicality of that is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And yeah, I would love to see like behind the scenes footage of that, like, you know, alternate takes.
Well, what's interesting is like, if you read his first book, his autobiography,
mm-hmm.
He talks about the production of that, and it was being filmed at the same time as Maximum Overdrive.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they were both filmed in South Carolina, and they actually loaned some of their crew to help with Maximum Overdrive.
Okay, I vaguely remember this. I read that book a while ago.
Wait,
this is sounding something
Dino De Laurentiis loaned, maybe I get that backwards. they loan some of the crew from Maximum Overdrive to help with Evil Dead. It's one or the other.
Yeah.
But it was, for me, it's this weird confluence of things that it's like, if I believed in fate, this would be a good example. You know, like,
mm-hmm.
those two movies are my favorites. That was my early exposure to Stephen King, rock music with AC/DC, and the hero's journey with Bruce Campbell as Ash. And come to find out, they were intrinsically linked like that.
Yeah, that is
such a wild. Odd thing. Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, well, this was... At least I come by it honest. I mean, this was meant to be.
That's pretty incredible. Yeah, I Bruce Campbell is such a fascinating guy.
Yeah.
Like, I love that he found his niche and perfected it. Every character he's played, you could kind of see a little bit of Ash in it, and not in like a he is limited in his acting range kind of way, but it's just like, this guy does this the best of anyone. And I don't know. I like that guy.
Yeah.
Back around to that other question I was going to ask before.
Sure.
So say someone is looking for a new author to find, and they say, oh, this, I like this name, Todd Kiesling. Where would you direct this person who knows nothing about your work to start? What would give someone the best idea of what your writing is like?
Well, it depends on what they're looking for. If they're in the mood for short fiction, then obviously my collections are, you know, the place to start. Similarly, like, if people ask me where to start with Stephen King, I always say start with Night Shift.
Oh, yeah.
Skeleton
Crew for me, but I take your point.
Yeah. So I would say if you're in the mood for short fiction, then you can't go wrong with the collections. The first was Ugly Little Things. And the latest is Cold Black and Infinite. If you're looking for a novel, depending on what kind of novel you're looking for, like if you want a full balls to the wall horror experience, then Devil's Creek is the way to go. If you want something more experimental, check out the Monochrome Trilogy. Those are my earlier novels. A Life Transparent is the first, then The Liminal Man, and then Non-Entity. Those are a little bit different. They're horror, but the horror is presented in different ways. It's also very metaphysical. If you want, you know, something that's going to leave you feeling hollow inside, then Scanlines is the way to go. And if you want something that is fun, creepy, cosmic, and deals with rock music, then The Final Reconciliation. And there is more on the horizon, but I can't say anything yet.
So, fair enough. Yeah, fair enough.
The next novel of mine that you'll see is heavily cosmic horror. I pitched it as Cocoon meets The Color Out of Space.
You just keep giving me these gifts, Todd. I'm here for it. Like, come on, man. Like, I swear you read like a journal entry of mine at some point. We're like, all right,
well, this is gonna be funny. I've been stalking you your whole life, so
perfect. Okay, good. I've always wanted a stalker, so I haven't. I don't know, like, that's man, but that sounds incredible. If people want to find you online, Todd, where can they do that? If you want them to.
Well, there's my website is kind of like a one-stop shop, really. ToddKiesling.com. I am on Twitter. I refuse to call it by its other name.
You and me both.
At Todd_Kiesling. And then Instagram, TikTok, just at Todd Kiesling, all one word. Blue Sky as well.
Awesome. So. Very cool. Well, Todd, thank you very much for coming on today. I really appreciate it. It's truly an honor. Yeah, no doubt.
Thanks, man.
I wish you all the success in the world, except for just that one thing. It's just not the brawl. I kind of don't want you to win that, but at the
same time, I don't expect to win that, dude. So it's all even yours.
Honestly, even if you did, I love Devil's Creek. There would not be 1% of me that's mad. I'd be like, that is a deserved win.
Thank you.
So, for sure, man. I will talk to you soon, bud.
Thanks a lot, dude.
Later.